Hi, this is Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out the podcast for Connecting Faith. You can hear the show each Monday through Thursday at noon Central. And remember, there are even more shows available on our website, myfaithradio.com.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hey, good Monday to you. Thanks for tuning in.
You've had a wonderful weekend. Glad to have you listening here to Faith Radio and particularly Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. Ryan Thomas there at the control boards, Grace Rife on the phones. And today is kind of a back-to-school sort of feel, I think, to our discussion today.
School, how do you feel?
We'll have an opportunity to learn a lot. That's what I'm thinking.
We learn a lot every day.
Well, yes. There's no quiz at the end, I think, so that's always helpful. Kind of ease back into it.
It is helpful.
But thinking about back to school, it's hot around the region. I was looking at the national map and see the sort of the USA Today map where there's pretty much bright red from central Minnesota down Iowa, Nebraska, and Missouri, and Oklahoma, and down to northern Texas.
It really becomes impactful when you attempt to do physical activity. I tried that yesterday, and it was an epic failure.
Twin Ports was like in the low 80s, I think, the next couple of days. So that's warm on the North Shore. So, but we have the humidity to go along with it, so that we keep our skin soft. We're going to head to Phoenix to talk with today's guest, and I'm really excited to have our friend Dr. Wayne Grudem back with us. He is a research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary, taught at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School for some 20 years, a former president of the Evangelical Theological Society, a co-founder and past president of the Council of Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. He was a member of the Translation Oversight Committee for the English Standard Version of the Bible and has written some 20 books or so. The latest one that we're going to talk about has to do with poverty and economics. You go, well, that doesn't sound like a theology book, but thankfully, Wayne brings his theological perspective to this, and it really is a wonderful resource. In fact, I was just noticing Rick Warren wrote on the back of the book, he said, should be required reading in every Christian college and seminary, relief and mission organization, and for every local pastor. This is a great resource. The Poverty of Nations, a Sustainable Solutions from Crossway. Wayne co-wrote it with Barry Asmus, who's a professor at Montana State University, or an economist at the National Center for Policy Analysis, I should put it that way. So, let's welcome Wayne to the broadcast. Wayne, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be with you.
This is an important topic because poverty has been one of those ongoing discussions, it seems like, for as long as probably most of us can remember, and the war on poverty, as it's been labeled here and there at different times, we've had various success and failures with that. So maybe we should talk about how we've tried to address this in the past. I mean, it seems like, I don't know, have we always sort of thrown money at the problem of poverty? That always seems to be the one solution that gets tried all the time.
Well, it's a quick solution to individual needs if, especially Christian organizations do a lot of good by giving medical aid or food aid to individuals or to communities. But Neil, as the map on the front of this book, The Poverty of Nations, the colored map on the front, map of the world, shows that those dark red countries and bright red countries are ones that remain trapped in poverty. Much of sub-Saharan Africa, a good part of Asia, including India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, and other countries in Asia and some in South America. Why is poverty so persistent in a world that in which many nations continue to increase in wealth? I began to work on this with my friend and colleague, Barry Asmus, who's been an elder with me at our church, Scottsdale Bible Church, but he is a longtime professional economist. And we began to see that principles from the Bible, combined with principles from economic history and the lessons of economics, can provide a solution to poverty that really very few people are talking about, not just meeting immediate needs, but dealing with the root causes of poverty so that countries become more productive and that people in those nations have jobs, not just welfare handouts from nations meeting immediate needs. So what we're doing is trying to address the problem of poverty not at the level of short-term immediate help for individuals or communities, but long-term structural change in the laws of a nation, the economic policies of a nation, and the cultural beliefs that a nation has. Those three areas, laws, economic policies, and cultural beliefs. And we believe if those things change, and we've listed actually 78 specific factors in those areas that need to be altered in order for countries to move toward greater prosperity. And we think if those are done, it's as economist Brian Westbury says in the endorsement on the cover, it's a bulletproof antidote to poverty. We think it really provides a long-term solution. That's why Rick Warren could say in his endorsement that this book will become a required text in all 196 countries in which they have mission teams. Mm. So we're excited about it. We think that really God in his word has provided principles of the rule of law and respect for property rights and many other principles about how government should function for the good of the people rather than good of their friends and relatives, principles that will bring about genuine change toward greater prosperity in all nations of the world. And those solutions will come from within the nations when leaders in poor countries decide to say, enough is enough. We're going to make some changes.
We'll talk more about some of these specifics as we go through the hour. And by the way, you're welcome to join us. We do have a couple of copies of this book, The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solution, from Wayne Grudem and Barry Asmus. If you, if you're maybe involved in some areas of ministry looking to alleviate issues of poverty, or just have economic policy perspective, this is a great resource really for anyone. You can join the conversation, of course, at any time at myfaithradio.com. Then just click on the Connecting Faith page and the email link there to send us a note that way, or you can call us at 877-93-FAITH. It's 877-933-2484. I want to talk, Wayne, because right the first chapter of the book, you talk about the goal, which is to produce more goods and services. And I'm wondering why it's always have to be about more. It seems like we always get the kickback sometimes to say, well, you know, this whole system is built on it's just more, 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 which is, you know, is that really a biblical framework, a perspective to pursue?
Well, when you're talking about millions, hundreds of millions of people living on less than a dollar a day, they obviously do need more. Hmm. They need more goods produced in their country, more food, more clothing, more and better structures to dwell in, and roads to transport goods, and incentives that will lead to greater productivity so that they can enjoy more of the material prosperity that I think God put human beings on the earth to enjoy. When God created the earth, Genesis 1:31, he said he looked at all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. And he told Adam and Eve to fill the earth and subdue it. And as I explained in this book, The Poverty of Nations, that Hebrew word to subdue, that really means to make it useful for the benefit of human beings. And so I think God intended Adam and Eve not only to, you know, pick the fruits and vegetables, but eventually to domesticate animals and develop ways of building small buildings, and then eventually means of transportation, and ultimately the modern cities and cars and planes and computers that we have today. All that is implied in the command to subdue the earth, to discover what is in it, to learn about its resources and how they can be made immensely useful for the benefit of human beings. That is creating more, but I think God put in us an inherent drive to want to do that, to invent, to create. It happens in a very simple way, Neil. The example we give in the book is a woman in a poor country that somehow gets enough money to buy a length of cloth for $3, and then she sews it into a shirt that she can sell in the market for $13. All of a sudden, she's added $10 worth of value to that piece of cloth. And she has created new value on the earth that did not exist before she did that. That is the process, when you multiply it by tens of thousands of times, that's the process by which every rich country on earth has grown wealthy in history. It's by taking the resources of the earth and developing them into useful products for the benefit of human beings. You know, this is just a human capacity that God has given us, and it's reflecting something of what it is to be in the image of God. We're in a small way reflecting God's activity of creation. He is the creator, and he's made us to be little creators of things on the earth in a way that glorifies him, and we should do that with thanksgiving to him. So another example, Neil, is I went into LensCrafters a while ago to get a pair of glasses, and I got to talk to the lab technician back in the room behind the glass there, and he had this little disc of plastic, and he gave me a couple that had, you know, were extras or had been ruined. And you look at it and you think it looks like a little circular ashtray or something, and it's just not worth anything. It's a piece of plastic, maybe 5 cents worth of materials, and he puts it in this machine and grinds it up, and out comes $100 lenses for glasses. Now, he's added $100 worth of value to the raw materials from the earth, and so with everything we have. God created us with a desire to learn how to do these things. It sets us apart from the animal kingdom. You know, rabbits live in the same kind of dens. Squirrels have the same kind of nests they have for generations. Beavers build the same kind of dams. But human beings want, they want to build a house, to invent a new kind of car, to invent an airplane, to invent a computer. And that drive is a good and God-given drive. It can be distorted. It can be used in sinful ways and greedy ways, of course, but inherently it's a good thing.
Mm. As, you know, as you talk about some of those illustrations about, you know, sewing a shirt or even just, you know, lenses, are the issues more about sort of individual ways that we overcome or create, or are these systemic national, you know, community or global issues?
Well, Neil, one of the things that that my economist friend Barry Asmus and I did in our research for this book was we investigated the economic development of all the nations and regions of the world, not some nations individually, but some regions. And we found that if you go back about 250 years or so, before about 1770, all the nations of the world were poor, and the economic situation of the average citizen in all nations was quite poor. I mean, people just lived pretty much hand-to-mouth, and there were a few wealthy nobles and princes and maybe a few wealthy merchants, but the ordinary class of humanity, there weren't rich and poor nations. There were some that were a little bit better off, but everybody was poor. Then the Industrial Revolution came along, and first in Britain and then later in Northern Europe and the United States. And things began to change, and people began to multiply their productivity, and nations grew wealthy by creating more things from the earth. Neil, I'm going to have to admit now, right? I got long in that story, and I forgot the question you asked.
We're just talking about if it's about just, you know, the fact that what we're talking about here is it individuals just being more resourceful, or is it about the systemic sort of problems of,
right,
you know, of a nation or even maybe just a community?
Okay, from an economic standpoint, and our study of the history of economic development over 250 years, as well as our study of biblical principles, led us to conclude that what governments have to do is just get out of the way and let the free market determine what is produced in a nation. And when the government does that, it has to provide certain protections and rule of law, protection against crime and things like that. But once it does that, if the government doesn't meddle too much and try to control what people do, you have what's called a free market economy. And that's, I mean, part one of our book is saying the economic system that really works in producing wealth has worked again and again and again throughout history in the wealthy nations of the world is a free market economy. And we define that as an economy in which individuals, not the government, decides what is to be produced and what is to be consumed. The opposite of that is communism or socialism, where the government tries to control everything and then they just trap people in poverty, as we see in North Korea or Cuba today, or the former Soviet Union, and still has remnants of that. So we don't think that's a helpful system. And we go through the history of other economic systems that have failed. We say a free market is really the basic building block of an economy that grows. The components of that have to be that there's documented ownership of property that's available to all the citizens in a country. There has to be a stability of the currency so there's no inflation that is runaway inflation. It has to be low and stable tax system. And once those things happen, the economic system is set. But it isn't just that, because if you have that working and you have corrupt government, or you have some people that are above the rule of law and can cheat and steal and get away with it, then, of course, it's not going to work. So the second section of the book is 17 factors that have to be implemented in terms of government. And then the last part of the book is what leads nations to do this, and that is the values that a nation has to hold to. So that's the overview of the book.
Well, Wayne, let's come back and we'll talk more about that free market system and the importance of the moral virtues that must go along with it, and get some perspective about worldview and values. Do economists even consider worldview and values when they're looking at solutions and predictions? We'll get to that in just a moment. Wayne Grudem is our guest today. Dr. Wayne Grudem is a research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary. And he has written a new book along with his co-author, Barry Asmus, who's a senior economist at the National Center for Policy Analysis, about The Poverty of Nations. That's the title of the book, The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solutions. And we'll dive in more with Wayne Grudem in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. 877-93-FAITH is our phone number. You'd like to join us, 877-933-2484.
If you're a parent of a teenager, you probably already know this. They know everything. Just ask them. Recently, my 17-year-old son Marco and I were in a heated discussion, and I was sure he'd be persuaded to take my advice because I had so many good stories and illustrations as to why I was right. I was just about ready to launch into another one when Marco stopped me. "Mom, enough with the stories. Give me some scriptures on what God has to say." "Yeah, right. So you better believe I grabbed my Bible and found four different chapters with verses I knew, and they fit brilliantly with our discussion. After reading, I asked Marco, "Does that help?" "Yes, Mom, it does. Now I just have to process it." "Yeah, me too," I thought. How can we hear God when we don't really know Him? To know Him is to know His Word, the Bible. Proverbs 3:7, "Do not be wise in your own eyes," which is what I was doing with my brilliant analogies. Ha! Things always work out best when God has the last word every day. For more encouragement, visit DebbieGriffith.com.
Past the hour, and you're listening to Connecting Faith. My guest today, Dr. Wayne Grudem, research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary, co-author of a brand new book called The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solution. It's published by Crossway, and I would recommend it to you for some great resource and research. And, you know, all of us, certainly as believers, have a stake in the war against poverty, and so we're looking for a permanent solution. We're talking about that today with Wayne Grudem, and we mentioned several things that center around the value of a free market economy. And I guess maybe before we talk about that, I'm wondering, Wayne, if economists look at worldview and value systems when they're making their predictions. I mean, you quote lots of authors that have written about poverty and solutions, and it seems like time and time again, they maybe overlook the fact of, you know, how people's belief system affects the outcome of what we might see economically.
I really think they do, Neil. We read through a lot of the literature on economic development theories that are around in the academic world today, and what we found is that economists just don't agree. In fact, you get some leading economic forums and leading economic authors saying there is no consensus today on what leads to economic development in poor nations. But we think it's because there are so many economists that have assumptions that keep them from looking at the big picture. There are what we call cultural equalizers who just decide they won't say a thing about the cultural values that lead to development. And there's a forum called Making Aid Work, which a number of professional economists contribute, and they can't come to a conclusion. And there's an excellent book recently by an African economist named Dambisa Moyo, and she has a doctorate from Oxford University in economics, and it's a book called Dead Aid. She says foreign aid simply does not work, but her solution to the economic problems of Africa is just stop the aid, and then development will naturally occur. But, you know, Neil, if you have a cultural belief system, for instance, that does not respect other people's property rights and thinks you can go into your neighbor's house and neighbor's refrigerator and take whatever food is there if you need it more than you think he does, well, you know, that's not going to lead to economic development very quickly. If you have a cultural value system that doesn't value private property and thinks you don't have to and thinks, for instance, that the tribe should own the property rather than individuals, you will not get economic development. If you have an economic system that thinks it's okay for a government leader to take tax money to enrich himself and build fancy homes and enrich his family and friends rather than serving the nation, if you have a cultural belief system that thinks that bribery is just the way things are and you can accept it as normal, if you have a cultural belief system that in many cases doesn't value economic productivity or thinks that anybody who gets ahead economically is being selfish or greedy and so, you know, is ostracized in the society, these are major, major factors that cause poverty to persist in a number of poor nations, and those have to be addressed.
We'll come back and circle back and talk about changing cultural beliefs as well. But I'm just curious.
I should say here just a second. Yeah. Pastors are really important in this campaign against poverty because pastors influence cultural values. And so that's a point at the end of the book.
Hmm. Interesting that on the cover of the book, you have a global map of the globe with obviously it's a good visual aid of countries that are prosperous versus those that aren't. And clearly, as we talked right at the outset, sub-Saharan Africa is some of the poorest of the poor. And interesting to me that, you know, we hear reports that, you know, Africa has one of the most maybe evangelized countries in terms of, you know, mission activity. So with all that sort of years of some Christian influence, why is it so dramatically impoverished compared to maybe other parts of the world?
Our conclusion, Neil, is that many individuals in poor nations in sub-Saharan Africa are born-again Christians. They've trusted in Christ as their personal Savior, and they've received the wonderful gift of eternal life and forgiveness of sins. But that the teachings of the Bible on economic questions, on the value of private property, on the fact that no ruler should be above the law but should be subject to the law, on the value of keeping one's word and one's business dealings, and many other things having to do with corruption in government, that those simply have not transformed the society. So we're saying we're especially hopeful for Christians in poor countries, Africa, Asia, Latin America. We're especially hopeful that this book will gain a hearing among them, and they will say, you know, not only personal salvation do we need here from the Bible, but also the values that will transform an economy and transform how a government works.
In a moment, I'll maybe just reverse it. We talked about, you know, without that proper teaching on the rule of law and on moral behavior and those virtues that a country suffers or a people suffers or a nation you know, a continent suffers. But I want to talk about if there's some examples where a biblical worldview had influence on prosperity, and we'll get to that and more in a moment with Wayne Grudem. As we're talking about a new book that he has co-authored called The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solution. Wayne Grudem has written 20-plus books. He was part of the Translation Oversight Committee for the English Standard Version of the Bible. I mean, he's written some of the standards when it comes to theology and a number of things. He's been a research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary for a number of years and taught before the Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, and has co-authored this new book with Barry Asmus, who's the senior economist at the National Center for Policy Analysis. And they're simply looking at what the Bible has to say about economics. And we're going to talk more about laws and economic policies and cultural values and all that in just a moment with Wayne Grudem. And we'd welcome your calls to the conversation at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. We do have a couple of copies of the book that we'll give away here at the end of the hour. If you'd like to join the conversation or have a thought to add to it, we'll talk a little bit about how do we deal with government officials that seem to be taking aid money or bribes, those kinds of things. We'll get to that and more, and talk about how the church has either helped or hindered. They've been part of the problem or part of the solution. All that coming up in just a moment with Wayne Grudem. It's 32 past the hour, and we're talking today on Connecting Faith with Wayne Grudem. Dr. Wayne Grudem is a research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary. I think the last time we talked to him, we were talking about politics and the Bible. Is that what the title of it was, Wayne?
Politics According to the Bible.
That's right, yeah. Just an amazing resource. This is another amazing resource at that Wayne has co-written with Barry Asmus, who's a senior economist at the National Center for Policy Analysis, The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solution. It's published by Crossway. And Wayne, we talked about, there are examples where even though Christian teaching might be evident, if we're not applying it, it doesn't have an impact in the economy. I'm curious, are there examples where a biblical worldview, you can sort of point to that and say, yes, because of this biblical worldview, prosperity has developed?
Yeah, well, let me say at the beginning, Neil, that of course, no nation is perfect. And in the history of the world and economic development in the world, no nation has done a perfect job of representing biblical cultural values. But some do that more than others, especially in the area of government, limited government, and rule of law, and protected property rights, and a free market economy. And what happened is, beginning in 1770 in the Industrial Revolution, in England, in the United Kingdom, the values were there in the society, and then the rest of Northern Europe. But here's what happened: per person economic productivity of England doubled and then multiplied six times more over the next 100 years or so, because there were many factors that were helpful. Number one, there was a long tradition of everybody in the nation being subject to the rule of law, going back to the Magna Carta in 1215, actually. But many biblical cultural values came to play, and then there was belief in the value of private property and private ownership of property. Great, great benefit came to nations when the Protestant Reformation spread to the Northern Europe, and Protestant believers were convinced that it was important to read the Bible, and it was important to teach their children to read so their children could read the Bible, and it was important to teach both boys and girls to read because they wanted their sons and daughters and grandchildren to be able to read the Bible. And once you have a literate population where way over 90% of the people are able to read in England, in Northern Europe, then that's a wonderful factor for increasing the diversity of knowledge and technological development. And if you have a Christian worldview that says the world is orderly and subject to rational investigation, you carry out scientific experiments. if you value honesty and truthfulness in business dealings and where you keep your word, if you say you're going to deliver a product on Tuesday at 11 a.m., you have it there at Tuesday at 11 a.m. or earlier. You value promptness in truthfulness of commitments. If you see that there is benefit in economic development, so you honor economically productive people, if you have respect for private property, many things in a country can contribute to growth in material prosperity. Now, people will always say, well, of course, doesn't that lead to materialism? It can. And so pastors and churches need to warn people that while God wants us to enjoy the good things from the earth and have cars to drive and houses to live in and good food to eat, we also shouldn't set our heart on any of those things, but keep our heart on God above all. And we say at the beginning of the book, material prosperity is a secondary issue, secondary to relationship to God and secondary to relationships with family and friends and community. And we say at the end of the book that while these things are taught and will lead to productivity on a material basis in a country, we have to keep reminding people that those are secondary, and the primary thing has to be relationship with God and friends and family and those relationships. And I should say that we say in the book, Neil, that many poor communities and poor nations, say in Africa, where there's large Christian influence, do better than many wealthy nations on the value of community and value of personal relationships and the value of personal relationship with God. So we're not saying we're rich in every sense, and we're saying that we can learn something about those values from the poor countries as well. But when we are taking specific focus to look on the question of why are people poor and poverty is so debilitating and so harmful and so dehumanizing to people, when we're looking at those issues of economic prosperity, then biblical values lead to a certain kind of economic system, a certain kind of governmental structure that serves the benefit of the people rather than the rulers, and a certain kind of value system that leads to greater economic productivity. And we think that is also a very important thing.
You know, at one point in the book, you quoted Paul Collier, I think, an article or a book, perhaps, saying poverty is not romantic. And he said, you know, the left is to learn to love growth. You were talking about, I think, a free market system. What is it about the free market system that sort of brings out there's so much antagonism toward that? Or I guess maybe just the word capitalism seems so bothersome to many.
Yeah, well, Neil, my friend Barry Asmus, the economist, and I, we talked at length about whether we should use the word capitalism in the book or not to describe the kind of economic system that we think historically has always led to growth around the world. And what we found from presentations in Europe, presentations in Asia, presentations in Latin America to poor audiences and rich and you know, business leaders and government leaders, what we found was there is such a wide variety of understanding of what the word capitalism means. It actually came from Karl Marx's writings, and it was a term he was using to the people he disagreed with. And it means greed to many people, and it means wrongful exploitation to other people. And we just thought, well, yes, we agree that in a technical economic sense, the system that we call a free market has also been called capitalism. But we thought, why use a term that has so much negative baggage? And so we decided what is at the essence of what we're arguing for economically is a free market system where the government doesn't decide what is produced and what is purchased, but individuals decide that. It's an amazing system when it functions. Neil, if I could just give a little example.
Sure.
I have here on my desk an ordinary yellow wood pencil with an eraser at the end and the lead part of the pencil at the other end. We argue in the book, and this is not original with us, we quote another person, Leonard Reed, but we argue in the book that nobody in the world knows how to make a pencil that you can buy for 5 cents. And the reason is that in order to get the wood, you have to have a logging camp, and you have to have earth-moving equipment and power saws and you have to have a factory to cut the wood into pieces. No single individual in the world can build the bulldozers and the tractors and the power saws that make the wood. And then you've got to get the brass from someplace else, from a copper mine, and you get the rubber, which is some kind of specialized material for the eraser, from another part of the world, and those are specialized factory, and then the paint and the design, and no one person in the world can do that. But what happens is the free market system throughout the world, people doing the logging, people doing the copper mining, people producing the graphite, they don't even know that they're making pencils. They're just getting a benefit from getting paid for something that the free market decides is valuable, and then all of a sudden a pencil appears. It's pretty amazing. And so it is with all the products that we buy today. Government planners don't have to decide who's going to make the wood, who's going to mine the copper, who's going to find the rubber, and who's going to find the graphite, and where's the paint going to come from. It just happens by people seeking to make a product that's useful for others and then gain profit from it.
You know, we're talking about examples of, I know that you spent a little bit of time on the issue of like free trade coffee, and where we, you know, it's not government planning, but this is more, companies or people that say, well, I want to make sure that there's some justice in the system, and so I'll just buy coffee that's paying the farmers more. You suggested that doesn't always work.
Well, no, it's good-hearted but soft-minded to think that fair trade coffee is going to make any dent in world poverty. The reason is it's basically a charitable contribution. You're saying, I'm going to pay a dollar more for a cup of coffee, so this will go to some poor coffee farmers in Latin America. Well, probably 1% max of the world's coffee market is affected by that, and not a lot of the money gets to the farmers anyway, and then there's a long waiting line for farmers who want to get into the system. But on an economic sense, it's basically a charitable contribution to those farmers. Well, if people want to do that, I guess that's fine. But what it's doing is doing two things. One is it's saying, well, eventually this will spread to other products, and you'll pay a dollar more for this and a dollar more for that and a dollar more for this. It's saying that the majority of the world will decide to pay a little bit more in charitable contributions for the majority of products that they're going to buy, and it's just contrary to human nature. It's never worked, and it will never work. And the other thing is, from an economic standpoint, it is giving a little more incentive for coffee farmers in Latin America to keep on producing coffee that has not and will not ever get them out of poverty, because the coffee market internationally is so competitive, so many places can grow coffee, that the price is never going to rise on the world market very significantly through that process. And what the farmers who can't make enough money growing coffee need to do, and we give example of some Latin American farmers who have done this in some countries, they need to switch to other crops, more profitable crops, crops that they can grow that are more uniquely demanded and will get a higher return. But if you give charitable contributions to them through free trade coffee, you are giving them incentives to stay in the industry that has not been able to support them in the first place. Well, why do you want to do that?
Yeah. Well, along those lines,
good-hearted but yeah. Soft-minded.
The along with that, tell me, has the church been part of the solution or part of the problem?
I do not think, Neil, we are not aware of any Christian book or any economics book anywhere that has combined a Christian approach to poverty and has looked at the problem from the systemic view of what affects a whole nation. We're not aware of anybody that's taken this view. Marvin Olasky, the editor of World Magazine, says of this book, many good authors have felt, many excellent authors have felt the elephant's trunk, legs, and tail. Wayne Grudem and Barry Asmus are the first to show the whole behemoth. Yeah. They explain clearly and simply what we must know to love those truly in need. So we're hoping that this will really be a conversation changer and give a new perspective to churches where they're trying to do individual things, and our church does some wonderful things to help specific needs on a short-term basis. But this, we think, will give a path that churches can approach to encourage nations to take steps that will solve the problem permanently and lift the nation as a whole from poverty to greater prosperity.
In a moment, we're going to return with Wayne Grudem. We want to talk about changing cultural belief and some of those important moral virtues that are one of the key aspects of a sustainable solution to the poverty of nations. That's the title of the book, The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solution. Wayne Grudem, my guest, who's a research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary and a writer of many wonderful works. And this is the latest, and we'll talk more with Wayne in just a moment. And take some questions and comments at 877-933-2484.
This is Wayne Peterson, president of HCJB Global, with Beyond the Call. When Willie Erasmus began producing the Jesus film for the Yao-speaking people in Mozambique, he was bombarded by obstacles. On the way to a remote recording session, he was assaulted by a man with an axe. And then a tire on his van was slashed. Next morning, he woke up with a high fever. And when the fever broke, technical difficulties started. Critical scenes were erased, and the power failed three times during the recording. Jesus in John 16 says, "In the world you will have tribulation, but I have overcome the world." Finally completed, the first showing of the movie was to 39,000 Yao-speaking Muslims, 6,000 of whom accepted Jesus as Savior. So, don't let obstacles or discouragement stop you from finishing a godly mission. Go beyond the call. And then visit us online at hcjb.org. That's hcjb.org.
Past the hour, talking with Wayne Grudem today. Dr. Wayne Grudem is a research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary's, co-author of a brand new book called The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solutions from Crossway. And it is an amazing resource. We talk about understanding the systems that seem to enhance and keep people in poverty and some of the ways to get out of that. And one of those is, as they talk a lot about, the free market system, and you say it promotes moral virtues. Talk about how that actually takes place and why those virtues are key. We sort of touched on it, but I think it's worth reviewing again the importance of honesty and some of those factors.
Well, Neil, when you talk to people about what's wrong in poor countries, sometimes they will say the first thing is there's so much corruption in government. But what is it that allows corruption to continue? Well, we think that underlying that corruption is a cultural value that allows government rulers, for one thing, to say they have the right to take the money from the taxes from the people and spend it on themselves. They have the right to enrich themselves. Rather than doing what the Bible says in Romans 13:4, the government, the agent of the government, is to be God's servant for your good, to do good for the nation. I was speaking to the prime minister of a relatively poor Eastern European country and said to him, Mr. Prime, and he wasn't a Christian, he came from a Muslim background, and I said to him, Mr. Prime Minister, after I'd given permission to mention a verse from the Bible, I had it in front of me, I turned to it, I said, I read this verse, Romans 13:4, about the civil authority is God's servant for your good, the Apostle Paul said. And I said, Mr. Prime Minister, I think God has put you in authority here in this country so that you could do good for the people of your nation. And he seemed actually, Neil, to be genuinely moved by that. It hit home in terms of facial expression and his comment back to me. We're saying there's a cultural value there. Why are you in leadership in government? Are you in leadership just to rob or take gifts from people if you're at a lower level of administration, which is actually bribery, coerced gifts? Or are you here to do good for the nation as a whole and do good for the people? If you're there, if the nation believes that, then there's a beginning of transformation to overcome corruption. There are some other, we list 35 values. I'll just mention a few more if I could, Neil.
Sure. Sure.
Right off the bat, the first value that will help a nation grow in economic productivity is that if the society believes that there is a God who holds all people accountable for their actions. If you think God's holding you accountable, you're not going to take bribes. You won't be dishonest about your product. You won't lie about your contract, and you won't seek to violate your word. And then the society believes that God, this God who holds you accountable, approves of work and productivity and developing resources from the earth. That's a cultural value. The society values truthfulness. You know, Neil, I teach an adult Bible class at my own church, at Scottsdale Bible Church, and I came to that section one time. I said to somebody in the front row, who was in the business world, who was a builder, and I said, you know, is truthfulness an important thing in your own business world? He said, yes, of course. He said, many times he'll make commitments involving $1 million or more over the phone, but the people he does business with trust him that he'll be good on those commitments. Well, that has a great value in economic productivity in a society. If all of a sudden truthfulness erodes, then you've got to have multiple government agencies checking up on people and enforcing people's promises. And then, of course, that costs a lot of money. It's not productive money spent. Then people try to bribe the government officials and the whole system breaks down. And just some smaller, what we call the minor moral virtues, importance of promptness rather than tardiness. We quote an economist in our book on page 328 that says, tardiness costs the nation of Ecuador upward of $700 million per year, more than 4% of their total economic production, just because of a habit of being late rather than being on time when you say you're going to show up. And so meetings can't happen on time and production can't start on time. That's a cultural value.
You know, it's just as you go through the, and those are.
We have 35 of them.
I was going to say they're fascinating reading, and I would recommend the study of it. But I'm thinking about, you know, even in our country, in our economic system, that, you know, we are seeing, I think, increased concerns about contracts being broken and issues of, you know, eminent domain and honesty. I mean, what happens as these get lost in a system where they have been the foundation?
It hinders the country economically. And more and more people find it a little bit harder to get by. I mean, it happens, you know, a little bit at a time, a dollar here, a dollar there. But what happens when when government failure or moral failure in the cultural values of a nation cost us more and more time and money, it basically diminishes the quality of life we have because it takes away our freedom. It takes away our freedom to decide to use our life and our time as we wish. It takes away the time that we can spend with family and friends. It takes away time that we can spend in church and ministry activities. It takes away time we can spend in caring for other people because we're just going more and more in the direction of seeking to spend enough time to earn enough to get by, just to keep body and soul together. So it's harmful.
Was there any, as you've gone through this and spent some time with your co-writer, Professor Asmus, who is a senior economist in the National Center for Policy Analysis and is a noted speaker, so you worked on this together, the poverty in nations.
We did.
Was there something, maybe an aspect of the, you know, Bible's teaching that maybe surprised you? I mean, you've been writing books in theology for a number of years. Anything that sort of jumped out at you that you hadn't really seen before?
Oh, many things, Neil, and it's hard for me to pick out one. I think I would say that the importance of private property and private ownership of property, you get that way back in the beginning of the Bible in the book of Exodus where God commands you shall not steal, as I shouldn't steal my neighbor's donkey or ox because it's his, it isn't mine. And there's a respect for private property. That's one. I think probably that there was a moment when things began to crystallize in what we were doing in the book, and that was when we came to the realization that before nations start to move from poverty to prosperity, they have to figure out what is their goal. Is their goal going to be to get more foreign aid? Is their goal going to be to keep on blaming trade barriers with other countries? Is their goal going to be to go on blaming colonialism or rich nations or rich countries or rich businesses? Is their goal going to be to try to equalize income in the nation? What should they do? And we ended up saying, you know, first of all, let's get the goal straight. The goal is to produce more. The goal is that this wonderful process of creating value that did not exist before, what I mentioned at the beginning of the hour, Neil, about taking $3 of cloth and making a $13 shirt, or taking 5 cents worth of plastic and making $100 glasses lens, or creating value of products, or a teacher teaching a class, or a doctor giving an examination. Those are services of value. What a country has to focus on in order to escape from poverty is to create more goods and services of value. And if they keep a laser focus on that as their economic goal, then all the other things will fall into place. God wants us to do that. I think it was inherent in the command to fill the earth and subdue it. And then the promises of blessing in the land of Israel. When they came into the promised land, it was a land with fruit trees and vineyards and olives and iron and copper in the hills, but they had to dig the iron and copper out and refine them. They had to harvest the olives from the olive trees. They had to pick the figs from the fig trees, and they had to pick the vines, the grapes from the vine trees, and they had to grow the wheat in the field. They had to work, basically, in order to produce useful products from the earth. So when countries focus, they shouldn't focus on just getting donations from other nations. They should focus on how can we work in a productive way and give incentives for our people to work in a productive way so they benefit from their work, and therefore sense the reward that God gives in blessing people with greater material resources once they have followed his purposes for being creative and productive with the resources of the earth.
Wayne, just have about 2 minutes left. I'm wondering maybe to see, you touched on earlier, so the pastors are really a key to part of this in terms of understanding the importance of the values. But maybe just a final comment about how we can, you know, as followers of Christ, really think clearly about these things.
Well, Neil, we're very hopeful that Christian leaders in poor countries will read this book. But also, we know that every church in America has some kind of relationships with mission activities in other countries. They have missionaries, they support missionaries, or they send mission teams. And many pastors in foreign countries come here to be trained. And we're hoping that there will be an influence from American churches as well to say, these are biblical values, and will you consider these? We've had a wonderful response from a number of Christians in poor countries who have said, you know, this is what our country needs. And we're hoping American Christians will first understand what causes poverty or wealth, and we think the book gives a good understanding of that, and then as God gives them opportunity, be able to influence people in poor countries. Ultimately, we can't change the countries ourselves. Those changes have to come with heroic leaders from within the poor countries. But we can encourage them and give support to them in their efforts.
And a good reminder, we have to be praying for not only our leaders, but leaders in other nations as well, that that justice would be done and righteousness prevail. So, Wayne, thank you for your good work on this. It is a fascinating book and just rich in its insight, The Poverty of Nations, A Sustainable Solution. It's published by Crossway. Co-authored by Dr. Wayne Grudem and the Barry Asmus. Wayne's a research professor of theology and biblical studies at Phoenix Seminary. He's been our guest today. Wayne, always enjoy talking with you. Thanks so much for carving out some time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Wayne Grudem joining us here on Connecting Faith. If you missed part of it, you can always catch the program on the podcast. We post that online at myfaithradio.com. And then click on the Connecting Faith show page. I want to just do a quick reminder. Tomorrow on the broadcast, we're going to think about how we think about God as we talk the God-shaped brain. That's the title of a new book. We'll talk about that tomorrow here at noon on Connecting Faith.